Haydn's piano trio in G major, known as the Gypsy Rondo because of that characterful finale. Playing it there, three musicians who are part of Radio 3's New Generation Artists scheme, the Atos Trio, violinist Annette von Hain, cellist Stefan Heinemeier and pianist Thomas Hopper. As always, do check out the New Generation Artists website for more information on these young musicians. The address is bbc.co.uk/radio3, and just follow the links. You'll find biographies, photos and videos with some of the performers talking about their lives and careers and what the scheme means to them. It's well worth a look.
Sarah Walker, and she'll be back with another New Generation Artists programme next Saturday evening at 7:15. This is BBC Radio 3. Now it's time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Rob Cowan.
Thank you very much, Jill, and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom, which is being given by the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra under their music director Yannick Nezet-Séguin. In the concert's second half, you'll be able to hear one of Beethoven's greatest symphonies, the Eroica, and after our opening overture, Simon Keenlyside joins the orchestra for some song masterpieces by Mahler, his Rückertlieder. First, though, the stirring overture to Wagner's grand romantic three-act opera Tannhäuser, which dates from around 1860 and has been described as Wagner's most medieval work. That applause, by the way, is for the orchestra's leader, Igor Gruppmann. The story goes basically that Tannhäuser has been excommunicated by the world and the church, but can be saved from his sins only by the pure love and self-sacrifice of the chaste Elizabeth, who is represented as the antithesis of the heathen goddess Venus. The overture has long been a favourite on concert programmes. It opens with a group of pilgrims emerging as from the distance before making their presence felt in a noble, brass-dominated climax. The agitated violin accompaniment was at the time thought by many to spoil the effect of the hymn, but in reality it seems more to add to the dramatic meaning of the music, suggesting the restlessness of the world as compared with the religious faith of the pilgrims. Then we hear the wildly sensual Venusberg music and Tannhäuser's passionate song in praise of Venus before the pilgrims return to triumph over all. Well, that applause is for Yannick Nezet-Séguin, who now conducts the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra in Wagner's Tannhäuser Overture.
Thank you.
Wagner's Tannhäuser Overture. The Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra was conducted by Yannick Nézet-Séguin. In rehearsal, Nézet-Séguin was talking about a sense of musical line and what he called following phrases to their proper musical destinations. And that was precisely what he achieved in that performance. Real shape to everything, and here he comes again. He articulates his intentions to the orchestra in perfect English. And now he cues the trombones and trumpets to stand, and the tuba. The horns, of course. Both sections playing magnificently, the woodwinds. And the full orchestra, including the strings. Those tricky figurations which they manage beautifully, I must say. Now the baritone Simon Keenlyside joins the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra for a cycle of songs by a composer whose whole musical world grew from the groundsprings of Wagner, and who, when Wagner died in 1883, was truly mortified. His name is Gustav Mahler. We're going to hear the five Rückertlieder. The texts are by the 19th century German poet, translator and professor of languages Friedrich Rückert. And Simon Keenlyside has chosen to end the group with perhaps the most moving of the songs. Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen. I am lost to the world. Intimate emotions which he has to project into a huge hall. Does he find that hard?
Rob, that's a $10 million question, I think. The distinction between, say, opera and Lieder, the two halves of my life, is that opera discusses the great socio-political, sexual issues of any day. And songs always, I think, almost without exception, as far as I can see in my little life, address how it is to get through the world and its hurly-burly, tail-chasing existence, you know, with a smile and a shrug, and the fact that you must get through it. You must. So are they intimate? Of course they're intimate. Because they are the workings of every human mind. This song, Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen, resonates with all of us. Every mature person at some point thinks, how can I? I've had enough of this. I've had enough of this tumultuous, industrial living, and I want to get away from it. You don't think that all the time, but Mr. Mahler puts it rather well. I don't like it to be sentimental. I don't feel as sentimental. This is a person who has chosen and is happy with the fact that he or she doesn't want that noisome world anymore and is happier where they are. But the reality is, of course, it's only for a short time.
Simon Keenlyside. Well, he begins the Rückertlieder with Ich atmet einen lunden Duft. I breathed a gentle fragrance, the fragrance of a sprig of linden. Then there's Blicke mir nicht in die Lieder. Do not look at my songs. The central song is Um Mitternacht, at midnight, I awoke and gaze up to heaven. And that's followed by Liebst du um Schönheit, a view, love for beauty. And then, of course, to finish, Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen. Well, that applause is for Simon Keenlyside and Yannick Nézet-Séguin, who now perform the Rückertlieder by Mahler.
Liebe Hand, wie lieblich böse Tat. Selber darf ich nicht getrauen, ihnen auf den zuzuschauen. Lecke mir nicht in die Liebe, meine Neugier ist Verrat, ist Verrat. Ihnen, wenn sie Zellen bauen, lassen auch nicht zu sie schauen, schauen selbst auch nicht zu. Wenn die Reichen Honig haben, sie zum Tag gefüllt haben, dann vor allen Asche liegen, dann vor allen Asche du, Asche du. Kämpft ich die Schlacht.
Well, has there ever been a lovelier song written than that? Not many, that's for sure. Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen. I am lost to the world. The last of those five Rückertlieder by Mahler. Sung tonight at the Proms by Simon Keenlyside with the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by their music director, Yannick Nezet-Séguin. It was so touching in rehearsal a couple of hours ago, the way Keenlyside would walk over to the edge of the stage, grasp the side barrier, and stand for a moment looking down, as if centering himself, maybe contemplating the power of Rückert's poems and the uncanny way that Mahler illuminates their meaning in music. And here they return now. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and Simon Keenlyside. So eloquent in that music. Real artistry. An artistry that, fortunately, has certainly travelled. He's appeared in recital in New York, San Francisco, Lisbon, Geneva, Moscow, Paris, Amsterdam, and at the music festivals in Edinburgh, Aldborough, Salzburg, Munich, and Schwarzenberg, the Schubertiad festivals. Well, I doubt that the audience is going to allow them to go without at least one more appearance. It's wonderful how Keenlyside managed to commune with this vast hall full of people. You could have heard a pin drop for most of the duration of those songs, especially the last one. And here they come again. Nezet-Séguin applauding this wonderful singer. He takes a deep bow. Obviously a profoundly modest man. Well, in 20 minutes or so, the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra under Yannick Nezet-Séguin return for a performance of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. But now it's over to Matthew Sweet, who hosted the latest event in this year's Proms Literary Festival at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening.
Hello and welcome to the Proms Literary Festival, our series of events that take the music surging out from the Albert Hall and panhandle it for concepts. And tonight we're going to deal with one of the biggest and most influential sets of ideas that Western culture has ever produced. Romanticism, a way of thinking about the world that has shaped and guided a bafflingly diverse gang of artists from Beethoven, Coleridge, Wilde, Goethe, the philosopher Richard Rorty and Tony Handley out of Spandau Ballet. These old, high and new are the Romantics. So let me introduce you to the guys who are going to help us get a grip on the Romantic project. They are the literary historian Jonathan Bate and the playwright Gabriel Badamosi, both of drunk deep of blushful hippocrene. I saw them doing it in the green room only moments ago, along with our reader, Andrew Sachs, who was booked not just because he's one of our most versatile actors, but because his middle name is Siegfried. Will you welcome them, please? Now, Romanticism, I suppose, is a rather slippery notion. It's one of those things that we all think we've got some sort of handle on, even if it's only rather a feeble one. But perhaps we should begin by saying what we understand by it. What do you understand by it, Jonathan Bate?
Well, for me, a really good starting point is a description one of the Romantics made of Goethe's great novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther. Young Werther falls passionately in love, ends up committing suicide. And the novel was described as a declaration of the universal rights of feeling. Romanticism belongs to the late 18th century and then much of the 19th century. And the great political event of that time is the French Revolution. And many of the Romantics are revolutionary, although some are profoundly reactionary. That, of course, was the period of the Declaration of the Universal Rights of Man and the beginnings of writings about the rights of women and indeed of animals. But Romantic art says it's the rights of feeling. whereas much of the art of the 18th century, of the Enlightenment, was concerned with the reason, with order, with structure. Romanticism, it's about passion, about strong feeling.
When I look at Romanticism, I kind of see it as the moment when actually the light broke through, when it dawned in people's brains, in their heads, in their hearts. And so in many ways, there's sort of a reasonably widely accepted version of when it begins is indeed the French Revolution. And people sort of cited in Rousseau, an Enlightenment philosopher, who basically said, look, our society, God didn't make it. We made it. We suffer it. We're responsible for it. And we can change it. And so on the morning that the Bastille comes down, people are plunged into an unknown moment in which they say, look, what are we going to do next? We can't look up out there at order, God's kind of rational universe. We have to look deep down in here at us. And we are capable of producing light, reason, love, feeling, gods and monsters.
Okay, well, let's hear something of the poetic voice of this movement. Andrew is going to read to us from Laus Veneris by Charles Algernon Swinburne. Jonathan, what do we need to know before we hear?
This particular poem, Laus Veneris, the praise of Venus, the goddess of love, is his version of the Tannhäuser story. Tannhäuser, in the medieval myth and in Wagner's opera, founds this sort of underground city called Venusberg, where we praise Venus, the goddess of erotic desire. So this is a bit of pure romantic eroticism.
Behold, my Venus, my soul's body, lies with my love laid upon her garment wise, feeling my love in all her limbs and hair, and shed between her eyelids through her eyes. She holds my heart in her sweet open hands, hanging asleep. Hard by her head there stands, crowned with gilt thorns and clothed with flesh like fire, love. Wan as foam blown up the salt-burnt sands, hot as the brackish waifs of yellow spume that shift and steam, loose clots of arid fume from the sea's panting mouth of dry desire. There stands he, like one labouring at a loom.
Now, Gabriel, there is a strong note of eroticism in that poem. Is that something that's a key component of this movement?
Eroticism. I think it is, and quite a lot of it has to do with thinking about the body. Many people reacted against, for example, the late 17th, early 18th century philosophy of people like Locke, who believed that out there is the world, and we have kind of sense perception, we can kind of absorb some things about it, and we take it away into the dark cave of ourselves, and we can reflect on it. And a romantic poet like Blake says, look, forget that. That's just a way of alienating yourself from the world. To really live, to have more life, to discover who you are and be free in who you are, you have to be in the world. You have to be part of the engagement. And in many senses, the loving and, for him, very often erotic engagement with the world. But of course, there are downsides to that. If I think, for example, of Coleridge, who struggles in his relationships, he thinks of viper thoughts that coil like kind of snakes around my mind. In many ways, his problematic is to engage with the obverse of love, which is hate, dejection.
So is this about the pursuit of, in a way, the documentation of true experience?
True experience, but above all, extreme experience. If you think of a romantic poet like Keats, writing about being half in love with easeful death, there is this obsession with death among many of the romantics. And a lot of the song cycles of the German romantic poets that then were taken over by romantic composers are very often death and the night are a big part of it. And here, again, I do see this reaction against the Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment is the idea of, you know, the light of reason. But the romantics seem to be saying there is another side, there is a darker side, a more intense, passionate side. We find that through erotic love, but we perhaps also find it through death.
So in what way is the kind of romanticism that we hear in Beethoven or Wagner, say, and the sort that we divine in the poetry, the same kind of concept? What is it that unifies all of these artists working in all of these different forms?
Well, to take, for example, the Tannhäuser, the Wagner, in which there is this kind of this mountain of Venus, and underneath there's this sort of court. Well, one can also kind of see that idea in English and Scottish popular ballads. That's the figure of Tamlin, who's kind of taken by the Queen of Elfin into her bower under the green hill, and then emerges sort of completely kind of strange and transformed by this experience of kind of untimely and unhuman love. So you can see there that Wagner has taken an idea about the kind of the demonic poet, obsessed with the kind of the power of these kind of visions, which can't then be fitted somehow back into the normal round of human daily human existence, and in many ways that is what he's striving to express in his music, that this is a human possibility which has been discovered in the late 18th, early 19th century, about the way man is not quite fitted to the society that he finds. The problem, I would say, is that many of the people from whom I learned about Romanticism had actually gone through the Second World War. They'd looked at the Nazis and the Nazi death cults, with Wagner somehow as its kind of its anthem. And they'd said, well, this kind of death-obsessed possibility is about the Germans saying they no longer want to be a Christian people, they want to be a German people. That there is always this possibility, both in the music and in the literature, that people are taking us down a very, very dark path. I don't know what you think, Jonathan.
Well, I think there is a toxic relationship between Romanticism and nationalism. One of the places where Romanticism begins is with the German late 18th century intellectual Johann Herder talking about the idea that authentic art always comes from das Volk, from the people. The long history of that in Germany is a very troubling one. But I think the main respect in which music is so central to Romanticism comes from the fact that at the center of Romanticism is the idea that art is about self-expression. The artist expressing his or her feelings is the most important thing. In a way, the form, the fact of artistic inspiration is more important than the content. And the thing about music is its pure form and pure feeling. It doesn't have representational meaning in the same way as the other arts. So the idea that the Victorian romantic Walter Pater said that all art aspires to the condition of music, that's a very central romantic notion.
Okay, well, let's hear something of what happens to romanticism when it gazes across a border into some other territory. Andrew is now going to read for us Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley.
I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, you mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
It seems to me, Jonathan, that Shelley has identified something that you only need to look at the TV news to see is something that, if not eternal, is something of a historical cycle that we still occupy.
There's a fascination among the Romantics with the processes of time, the decay of empires. I mean, again, one of the Enlightenment ideas would be history is progressive. But the Romantics are fascinated by the ruins of empire, by the way that history in the end leads only to destruction, to fragmentation. And the figure of Ozymandias, this Oriental emperor, imagining he had an empire that would last forever, and he's just reduced to ruins in the desert. time is the winner there, and that's a big romantic theme.
But when these poets gaze back at these civilizations, I mean, here we're sort of in ancient Egypt, aren't we? And yet it's something terribly vague too, isn't it? And when Coleridge talks about Kublai Khan, you know, a leader of 12th century Cathay, he's not really talking about a historical figure. Is this sort of invocation of these strange mythical pasts beyond the borders of Europe, is that something to do with the rejection of the Enlightenment as well, Gabriel?
No, I would say that it was quite distinct. This is a very interesting kind of short poem by Shelley. He wrote it in competition with a friend of his who also wrote another version of an Ozymandias poem. Literally, Ozymandias is supposed to be Ramses II, a sort of an ancient Egyptian pharaoh. But you and I listen to it and we see the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein, don't we? We see kind of Stalin toppling over in Tbilisi or something. And I would say very much, since people this evening are going to listen to the Eroica, we can hear kind of Beethoven tearing up the manuscript and tearing off the name of Napoleon Bonaparte and saying, these guys have got clay feet, they're tyrants, they've declared themselves emperor. So it's very much about looking at a kind of across time. I think you're quite right, Jonathan, the eternal vanity of human aspiration. But there's a very interesting and very often missed frame within this poem, which is that there's this sort of scene of destruction and boundless and bare, the lone and level stand stretched far away. That's about time. And if you think in the lyrical ballads, the founding document of the English Romantic movement, Wordsworth speaks about the vast empire of human society spread all over the globe and across all time. That is their theme.
There is a tremendous interest among the Romantics across Europe in non-Western culture, in Oriental culture. There's a fascinating English figure, William Jones, who saw in Hindu culture a model for a kind of enlightened organic society. And indeed, the poet and scholar Rückert, who Mahler's Rückertlieder is based on, he was an Oriental scholar. And I think the idea that there are other cultures with different ways of thinking about nature, history, human relationship, that's a very interesting dimension of Romanticism.
It should be said that the study of Sanskrit in Europe, which really kicked off, I'd say, in the early 18th century and then led to this massive growth within German philology, was basically that they discovered that the grammars of the within Sanskrit were so much more complex, so much more interesting and descriptive than European grammars, that there was this enormous growth in knowledge and understanding which had come from outside. And it seems to me that Romanticism is a portal within European culture of openness. Suddenly, it could absorb the rest of the world, could learn from it.
Well, there was a figure who was trying to absorb most of the world, wasn't there, in this period, Napoleon Bonaparte, who is one who received a great deal of attention from the poets associated with this movement. Andrew is going to read to us now from Byron's Ode to Napoleon Bonaparte.
The triumph and the vanity, the rapture of the strife, the earthquake voice of victory, to thee the breath of life. The sword, the scepter, and that sway which man seemed made but to obey, wherewith renown was rife, all quelled. Dark spirit, what must be the madness of thy memory? The desolator, desolate, the victor, overthrown, the arbiter of others' fate, a suppliant for his own? Is it some yet imperial hope that with such change can calmly cope, or dread of death alone? To die a prince or live a slave, thy choice is most ignobly brave.
Jonathan, is Napoleon being offered to us here as a kind of contemporary Ozymandian figure?
Absolutely. If you were a sort of effete poet who's, you know, struggles to get out of bed, let alone to, you know, to hold down a job, the idea of this man who could command the whole of Europe was incredibly charismatic. But at the same time, Napoleon did eventually declare himself emperor, and in some ways he seemed to be becoming like a kind of king of the old regime that had been overthrown by the revolution. So many of the Romantics became disillusioned with that aspect of Napoleon, and indeed looked forward to the day when eventually his empire would crumble just like that of Ozymandias. And Byron wrote this poem after the defeat of Napoleon. He talks about the triumph, but also the vanity. And of course, Beethoven, famously having dedicated the Eroica Symphony to Napoleon as a heroic figure, after Napoleon was declared emperor, crowned by the Pope, he tore up the dedication. He felt Napoleon was no longer a revolutionary hero.
There is that wonderful moment in the Keats Ode to a Nightingale in which, you know, he's kind of listening to the nightingale and thinking about death. He's thinking, now more than ever seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no sound, whilst thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Lots of people look at that and they say, well, coming to the Napoleon point, well, that's a poet who's kind of looking at death in a rather kind of self-obsessed way. And it's slightly ignoble. What's brave about that? The West Indian writer and thinker C.L.R. James always quoted precisely that passage and said, think of these young romantics here in England at a time of reaction when most of the people in this hall wouldn't have had a vote. Probably you'd still have been living in villages or chained to a machine in one of the cities that we had, these smokestacks. He can hear this music, this song, this beautiful thing, freedom in France. The people have risen up and they've overthrown their prison and their prison guards. That is a most beautiful accomplishment, and this is a moment at which I could die. And it seems that 15 or 17 or 27 years later, the defeat of Napoleon and Byron writing rather bitterly this kind of image of a Napoleon who's kind of imprisoned like a sort of an exiled king in the underworld. Is that ignoble? Is that brave? What has happened to this great social, because it was shared, this great social vision we have had of freedom? Hasn't it come to nothing? And I feel that it's very much an open question.
Keats wanted to cease upon the midnight, but we have to be a bit nippier than that, I'm afraid. But there is time for you to signal your full-throated approval of Jonathan Bate, Gabriel Badamozzi, and Andrew Sachs. Thank you.
Thanks to Matthew Sweet and the producer of the programme, Zahid Wali. And welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, which is being given by the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra under their music director, Yannick Nezet-Séguin. We'll be hearing a work that, you could say, changed the scale and even the expressive potential of the symphony forever, Beethoven's Third, his Eroica, which was born at a time when he was facing winds of great change, both personally and politically. A year before writing the symphony, in 1802, Beethoven had drafted the so-called Heiligenstadt Testament, a confessional statement where he confronted the terror and trauma of his encroaching deafness. He contemplated suicide and with stoical resolve cast the notion aside. Running parallel with this huge personal issue was Napoleon, who at the time Beethoven greatly revered, and his professional involvement with the ancient figure of Prometheus, the heroic benefactor of mankind who, in the world of Greek mythology, drives ignorance from the people of his age and gives them manners, customs, and morals. A sense of morality is at the heart of so much of Beethoven's music, but how should it actually sound? Tonight's conductor, Yannick Nezet-Séguin.
It's important to let Beethoven sing. And the rhythmicity of Beethoven and the fact that his writing with short motives, and that's the essence of what he's developing. Sometimes I feel that we try to forget how melodic this composer is. And in the Eroica, because of its dimensions, which arguably are Brucknerian of proportions, we find, especially in the last movement and the second movement, very long lines, unusually long lines. So that's very important, those feminine lines, to bring them into the music and feel that warmth, which complements so well this will of breaking everything around him. I'm especially happy that this symphony has been very important in my development as a musician. I conducted very often, and with the Rotterdam Philharmonic, we made a tour 2 years ago in Japan and China with this symphony, and we recorded it live. It was part of our very first moments together. So to come for the first time at the Proms together with that symphony and with the evolution that we had in the past 2 years and a few months together is really symbolic for me.
Yannick Nezé-Séguin. As to the symphony itself, the opening marked a total break with the past. Two decisive chords lead to a tranquil first idea, a seamless melody that slowly unfolds before the onset of dissonance tells us that our journey will be troubled as well as sublime. The symphony's second movement is a funeral march with lofty interjections, shocking key changes, and at the end of the movement, after a last heartfelt plea, the hopeless and, in musical terms, revolutionary fragmentation of the principal theme. We're left dazed, disorientated, and bewildered, but not for long. The next stage of our journey is a rugged Beethoven scherzo, like Mendelssohn after a workout. Athletic music, light as gossamer, and with a hearty horn-dominated trio. And then there's the finale, which, appropriately given one of the symphony's founding inspirations, is based on the main theme from Beethoven's Prometheus ballet. After a vigorous rush of excitement, we tiptoe on pizzicato strings and meet a Hungarian gypsy band. We encounter all sorts of rhythms and colours before the mood calms for an extended preparation for the final heroic presto. And if you've never heard the Eroica Symphony before, I envy you the experience. It is one of the titanic symphonic experiences. And here, that applause for Yannick Nezé-Séguin, who now conducts the Rotterdam Philharmonic in Beethoven's Eroica Symphony.
Thank you.
Yannick Neffet-Séguin was conducting the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra in Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E-flat, the Eroica. An almost balletic performance at times, really light on its feet, but with plenty of gravitas in the Funeral March second movement. And if you were listening in stereo, perhaps you will have noticed that Neffet-Séguin divides his violin desks left and right of the rostrum, the firsts and the seconds divided. Plenty of antiphonal effects in that symphony. As with the Wagner that we heard at the beginning of the programme, some very sensitive phrase shaping there. Here it comes again, applauding the orchestra. The flautist there did some wonderful work, especially in the finale. The three horns projecting well into the hall. Bassoons, clarinets, trumpets all stand to acknowledge this enthusiastic audience. Fairly packed actually tonight, the whole orchestra stands. And Neffet-Séguin takes a bow. It's wonderful really that a work like the Eroica still has the power to pack a concert hall like this Royal Albert Hall tonight and keep everyone spellbound for 50 minutes or so. I'm sure many of you treasure memories of first hearing this work in concert. Probably a lot of you at the Proms. And here he comes again, Yannick Neffet-Séguin, cueing his orchestra to stand. After that fresh and invigorating performance of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. looks fairly elated. And I must say the orchestra looked pretty pleased with themselves too. That second movement, the funeral march, is frequently performed on memorial occasions. Oh, wait a minute, there are some more players coming on onto the stage here, so I think we can expect an encore. So, some extra percussion, for example, some more woodwind. So, what might this be? Well, we're about to find out. Yannick Nezet-Saguin has just reappeared. He mounts the rostrum, and now, let's see. Well, I can just about tell you what that was, because I'm afraid I have to confess it always brings a lump to my throat. The Fairy Garden that closes the Mother Goose Ballet by Ravel. Tonight's prom, the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, was accompanied by their music director, Yannick Nézet-Séguin. Wonderfully warm textures there from the Rotterdam strings. And what a final climax. Well, it's been quite an evening, I must say. A great mixture of styles that have shown this fine orchestra off to fine advantage under this very talented conductor. And back he comes to acknowledge the applause. The orchestra rises to its feet. A satisfying conclusion to an extremely satisfying prom. Well, tomorrow night at the proms you can hear Mozart, Haydn and Bartok, and tomorrow afternoon a celebration of Rodgers and Hammerstein. But now it's time to hand you back to Jill Anderson in Broadcasting House for the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. That was Rob Cowan at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, tomorrow afternoon we've a prom as well. Petro Trelawney will be introducing a programme marking the 50th anniversary of the death of the American lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. So I thought we'd hear now the overture to Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel. It's the Carousel Waltz.
Thank you.
Carousel Waltz by Richard Rodgers. It was played by the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, conducted by John Malseri. And tomorrow afternoon at 4 in our first prom, there's a celebration of Rodgers and Hammerstein with John Wilson conducting a starry cast and a starry orchestra. And you can hear that live here on BBC Radio 3. Well, next this evening, The Wire, new drama. Tonight's play, first heard last October, is The Lady of Kingsland Waste by the new writer Jay Parks, who picked up his intimate knowledge of the Hackney neighbourhood as a traffic warden there. The production was recorded on location in and around Kingsland Waste with a largely local cast. The Lady of Kingsland Waste by Jay Parks.
You don't have to do this, Rhett.
I know.
You know, though. You don't have to, right, Bernie?
I know.
But you're going to do it, though, right?
Do you think I'm pretty, Knowledge?
That ain't the point.
Does that mean no?
You're going to do this, or what?
Do you fancy me?
I respect you.
Does that mean no?
You're going to drink your milkshake or not, Bernie?
Respect is good.
Well, yes, no. So... Miracle. Oi, boss. Burger boss. Over here. Poison this girl with a poison shake. Oi, boss. Oi, boss man, come. Give us our pennies. Give us double our money or we're heading straight down the environmental health squad. Comprendo?
Oh.
Let me help.
I can manage.
Let me help you.
I can manage, Pastor. Thank you.
Is it the pain?
No.
Are you in pain?
No. It comes and goes.
Would you like me to pray with you, Juliet?
It's gone now.
Partake of the cup. Drink, for it is my blood, which is shed for many, for the remission of all sins.
It was only a mug of tea. I'm all right, thank you.
Our Lord knows your sufferings. At the Last Supper, he drank from the cup of sorrow.
I've had more Last Suppers than you've had hot dinners, Pastor. I'm feeling better now.
I will pray for you, Juliet.
Thank you.
I'm going to blow him away.
Listen to yourself, Nathan.
My belt buckle.
He's deeply bored, boy.
You think it's all just this crazy repartee I is saying?
Repartee? Listen to yourself. Repartee? Who says repartee?
It's a good word.
It's misused.
I'm misunderstood.
You're not leveling the head.
I really hate him.
Of course you do.
I'm going to lick him.
You're going to go over to Perfect Burger and share his fries more like.
No way. No way.
Then he'll buy you a strawberry shake and everything will be rosy cozy.
You'll
what?
Stab him in the eye with a straw.
Okay.
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 See you then.
Where you going?
I'm going over to Perfect Burger to watch this big straw assault like.
You don't understand. The man has no respect for me, Ralph. None. Nor any, nor none.
All he said was your shirt was from Asda.
It ain't from Asda.
It is though, innit?
It's customised.
It's from Asda with the label cut out, Nathan. Now, come on. Come on. You coming then or what? See you later.
It's customised Asda from down Kings and Waste Market. I'll have 3-6 Mafia gear, actually. Actually. Wait up, Ralph. Ralph?
Ralph, wait for me.
10 quid, that ain't bad, is it?
I can't.
Guys, right, stop though, Bernie, yeah? Okay, yeah? Be a good girl and stop it now.
I can't.
What?
Metabolize lactose.
Toes? You've got a lack of toes?
Don't laugh at me, Knowledge. It ain't funny. I hate it.
Sorry, okay? What's that thing all about then?
It means milk makes me sick.
Oh. A tenner though, huh? And we got a couple burgers and fries out of it. Does Red Bull make you puke up and all?
I don't think so.
What about kebabs?
No.
Hiya.
Oh.
Bernie, what's... What has happened to you?
Yo, beautiful.
What have you done to my sister, Knowledge?
Me? What have you done? Nothing.
What have you done, Knowledge?
It weren't me, it was milk.
You made her drink milk?
I didn't make her drink, she drank.
Oh, you mug.
It was only a little sip.
She can't have no dairy, none. This is what happens if she does.
I can't have those baby-sized cherry tomatoes, me. When I crunch them in my mouth, they make me think of zits bursting. And it feels like all the pus is trickling down my throat. Oh,
shut up, Nathan, man.
I ain't even talking to you. You just did.
Bend it over, Bernie. That's it. Here. I'll hold your hair back. It's going to be all right, girl. Let it out. Mind your clothes.
Yeah? Aim for Nathan's blouse instead, Bernie. Watch you.
What am I supposed to be watching, huh?
Just watch it, okay?
Stop it, you two.
Oh, that shirt.
It's gonna be okay, Bernie. Bend over, let it out.
Look at my shirt, man. Look at my new shirt.
Compute for 2012, she could.
Brang! It's covered in all little bits of cheese from the sink.
It's French fries.
What?
It ain't cheese, it's French fries, isn't it?
Oh. Your mum always makes me feel like...
You made her drink dairy so you could make some cash.
We did a deal.
I don't believe this.
I don't believe this shirt. It's proper redundant now.
Well, I didn't mind doing it, right?
See?
Look at it.
Let's get you home, Bernie.
I was going to share the cash. Can't
then I'm
going to
come back and sort you out later, knowledge.
Yeah, you slay him, right?
I shut it as the boy.
Hey!
I don't believe you do something so stupid.
I'm just jealous of my street style, man.
I ain't.
What street? Coronation?
I ain't going to make it down the road.
Well, let's go.
Actually,
DC. Dawson Century Shopping Centre.
I'm going to be six and more.
No, DC, as in...
Okay.
DC's...
Okay. I ain't never going to make it that far, Raph.
I don't care what
there's a toilet
think.
Over there.
DC.
Let's get
still
you
in
inside.
America, innit?
Yo, on,
I don't care what you think, because you know nothing, knowledge.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's one of them ones that needs a 10p?
Yeah.
Knowledge.
What?
10p.
I only got a 10 off.
Now!
He was forever touching me.
Pardon?
He had such... big hands. He was always touching me. We was married 30 years, Ma Leslie and me. Touching. Always touching me. What do you think about that, Pastor?
You must have been very close.
We were. It's a very small flat. We was married 30 years and he's been gone 30 years. What do you think about that?
You must miss him.
And we only ever had a queen-size bed.
Has a nurse been today, Juliet?
What day is it?
Wednesday.
I don't know.
Can I get you anything? Have you got enough milk?
Always reaching out to me. Reaching. Always wanting to touch me. Like a little puppy. Feeling my face, putting his paw out, always hanging on to my hand in case it suddenly weren't there no more. He's been gone 30 years, and we was married for 30 years. Tell me what you think about that, Pastor.
I pray he's at rest in the mansions prepared for us by our Lord.
I hope the beds are bigger there.
Yes.
He was big. Big man, but he was like a little boy inside.
He said, suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God.
I don't think so.
Pardon me?
I don't think I've got no milk in.
Everyone asks after you at church.
Do they?
Of course. We mention you in our prayers.
Which ones?
Which ones?
Which prayers?
Well, Sunday prayers for those in need of comfort.
What do they say?
Well, we pray for God's love and mercy upon you.
God's love and mercy upon me?
Yes.
Well, don't we all need that?
Of course.
So why do you single me out when that's what all of us need, Pastor?
Because...
Because... I'm going to die soon?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to get my mum to wash this sick out by hand now.
Okay, don't keep going on about it.
I was just laying the bare facts, knowledge.
How long's Bernie going to be in the toilet? She's been in there for ages.
You shouldn't have made her pig that milk then, should you?
Shut me.
Maybe she's got that thing.
What thing?
You know, that thing. What's it called? Bull mania.
What?
Bull mania.
You're mad in the head, you know that?
It has been said.
Not enough, we're not enough.
She's quite pretty actually, ain't she?
You rough.
Bernie.
Bernie?
I'm only saying.
You fancy a chance to do your name?
Shut it, knowledge. All I said is that she's a bit sweet looking, when she's not heaving up all over my new gowns.
Bernie, what are you doing in there? Let me in.
She right in there, Ruff.
What do you think?
Those toilets only let you stay in them for a bit, then the floor tips upside down and everything gets flushed away. If you're still in there, you get flushed and all.
Shut up, Nathan.
I'm only saying because it's true.
Nathan, just give it a rest, innit?
This is all your fault, knowledge.
Yeah, knowledge.
You don't think she's, you know...
What?
You know.
What?
Got flushed away and drowned till she's dead.
Quit it, Nathan, okay? Raph, I'm sorry. I didn't know she'd take it so bad.
Bernie, open this door now, or... Bernie! Burn!
Old bird next door to us. She's on her way out as well. She's about 110.
Nathan!
Bernie!
I'm only saying she's on her last legs, but she won't want nowhere no more.
Maybe we could put another 10p in the sort to open it.
Money won't work when there's already someone inside.
Lives in a two-bedroom flat on her tod. Mum says we have to keep quiet when we go past the door, but we don't bother much. She used to give me 10p's when I was a kid sometimes. It's always wrapped in a bit of toilet paper. That's what's going to happen to Bernie inside there when the toilet machine tips over. She'll get all the paper and stuff wrapped around her.
Nathan, shut up.
Bernie!
Let's see if we can get the door to budge open.
Nah, it won't work. It's probably in the sewers now.
Do you want me to knock you out, man?
No?
Well then.
Stop
well
it, you two. Bernie, please. Please, open the door.
I'm sorry, Raph. I'm sorry.
But don't cry, Raph.
You want me to give you a hug?
What?
A hug?
He fancies you, that's what he means.
I don't believe you two. I hate you for what you've done, Knowledge.
Raph, I didn't mean
to... I don't never want to speak to you ever again.
Raph?
Keep away from me.
Ah, man, you is well in there.
No, what are you doing? Don't, you're taking a piss, man. Seriously, no.
The door? The door's opening. Bernie? Are you all right?
I thought I heard...
Are you feeling all right now?
I thought I heard a voice inside there.
That was Mog, we're here.
Don't call me a Mog, you Mog.
I was scared, Bernie. Don't ever do that to me again, babe.
I heard you lot out here shouting, but I heard someone else inside the toilets.
Are you feeling okay now?
I think I heard a voice inside speaking to me, Raph.
Come on, girl, let's get you home and away from these two clowns.
It was talking and there was this...
What? This what, Bernie?
This sort of... really bright, sort of, I don't know, this white light everywhere.
Weren't you enjoying that, Juliet?
Oh, music makes me head muddled.
Sing unto him, sing psalms unto him. Talk ye of all his wondrous works.
I prefer listening to the silence, Pastor.
You know, I talk to God when everything is silent.
Then it can't be that silent, can it?
I suppose not.
What does he say to you?
Pardon me?
What does God say to you when you talk to him?
He listens.
He doesn't speak?
His words are the signs and wonders he shows me.
So he doesn't talk to you then?
He is my guide in all things.
That's nice.
Yes, it is.
Well, Leslie was like God.
Beg your pardon?
He could go ages without saying anything.
Was Leslie a religious man?
He was very fond of Sundays.
The Lord's Day.
He used to check his pools before dinner.
I see.
None of the locals would live in these flats. We were the first. We were the first for years, till the black people came. They didn't mind. They didn't know. The first blacks I saw was when one of them knocked on our door and said they'd moved in upstairs. They were nice neighbours. Good parents. Good people.
What didn't they know?
I don't know what they didn't know. I never asked them.
About these flats. What didn't they know about these flats?
They knew a good thing when they saw it. It happened in 1941.
Pardon me?
The ground was cleared after that. Wasteland. Even the dogs didn't come near. But we did. And then the blacks with their kiddies.
1941?
I used to listen hard in the silence to hear if I could hear them. Those little toddlers.
Your neighbour's children?
Oh, not them. I didn't need to listen out for to hear them. No. Always running around.
So what children are you talking about then, Juliet?
The ones who was killed here, of course.
Killed?
Leslie said, dead is dead, and the dead are dead. But I listened out for them all the same.
How did they die?
In 1941.
Was it a bomb?
Took the whole building with the four of them in it. We left a deep hole here at the end of the road. I always listened out for them. Leslie used to say I was silly, but I still listened out.
And what did you hear?
Nothing.
Oh.
Not a squeak.
Of course not.
No. Not till my Leslie passed. Then I heard them.
The children?
After my Leslie passed on, I started to hear them. Chasing around, in and out. Shouting and racing.
The dead children? You think you heard dead children?
And they were so, so...
What?
Happy.
Knowledge. You're a knowledge boy. All three, man.
What's up, fam?
Look, see these?
What are those?
Trainers, blood. We bought them some bottle stool over there. Only 20 big peas. Nice, huh? But the thing is, you can peel the top pattern off, but there's another one underneath. So when the first one gets a bit manky and everything, you just rip off the pattern and it's like you've got a new pair of trotters underneath.
Fantastic.
You get more than you see?
If you say so.
Splendid, ain't they?
If you say so.
Well, splendid, ain't they?
If you say so.
They're splendid. They're the splendid of the splendid.
Stop saying splendid, Nathan, okay? It's getting on my nerves, man.
You still moping about Raf then?
No.
Ah, boy. Get yourself a pair of these treads. That'll cheer you up. Market blokes only got them in tens. I'm a seven. But he sells extra, extra thick socks and all. That's well sortable. There she is.
Who?
Raf, she's over there by the trailers. Hold up, Knowledge. Don't run. Knowledge. Don't run so fast. These trainers are like well heavy.
Boss? How's it? Hi.
What do you want?
Nothing.
Disappear then.
Don't be like that, Raf.
Yeah? Raf. Want to see some very excellent trainers?
No.
How you been, Raf?
Where's Bunny?
She's in there.
In the toilets again. You've been supplying her with some additional cow juice, Knowledge.
No more warning, Nathan. Shut up.
She's been coming to the toilets every day since that first time.
Where?
She's doing a do, ain't
Nathan.
She?
Nathan.
She thieved her dad's change bottle where he saves all his 10p's. He ain't happy.
She must need the toilets bad, like.
What's she doing in there?
She's not right. She ain't been right. Not since...
Bernie, it's Knowledge. You in there, Bernie?
She keeps saying...
Bernie, it's Nathan. Your 20 minutes is almost up.
Bernie!
It'll be cool, Raf. Don't worry.
Bernie, don't keep doing this.
Raf, don't get so...
So what? So what? Don't get so what, Knowledge, eh? Hey, tell me what?
Angry?
Look, she's coming out.
Bernie?
Hi, Bernie girl. What's up?
I heard her again.
Raf?
She spoke to me again, inside there.
That was Raf shouting.
Not Raf, she.
Who?
Her.
Don't do this, Bernie. Don't keep doing this.
Wanna see my new trainers, Bernie?
She spoke to me again.
Who's she, Bernie?
She spoke to me through the water and life.
Don't, Bernie.
What did she say?
Don't, Bernie.
She told me not to tell anyone.
Please don't, Bernie.
She said, I can't tell anyone.
Please.
Till what?
Till her message is needed.
Can you hear them, Leslie? Leslie. Leslie. Who is that? Who's that?
It's only me.
Who?
Me from up there.
Leslie?
Nathan from upstairs, lady.
What you want?
Mum said to ask if you needed any milk.
Milk?
Yeah, from inside cows. And sometimes goats.
Goats?
Hello, Al. So, do you need any?
I don't know.
I'm going to the shops. Nothing too big, though, because Mum wants some potatoes and something else. Oh, yeah, and some milk. I can't carry much, though. It's because my trainers are like criminal murder.
Oh, you better come in. I'll go and check the fridge.
Okay. What's that smell?
Pardon me?
It smells like old woolly jumpers or something. I quite like woolly jumper smells. So do you have any milk then, lady?
How old are you, Nathan?
Old enough to buy milk.
You're a cheeky little boy, ain't you?
I ain't no little boy. I'm 18.
You don't look 18.
That's because I'm 14.
Then why did you say you were 18?
In case you wanted me to get you some rum instead of milk.
Oh, don't drink rum.
I do. You'll have a heart attack if you're not careful, lady.
It's too late for that.
Weird or what?
Do you want to sit down?
What for?
To keep me company.
What for?
Because I'm old and you're young.
I don't have much time.
Nor do I.
Okay then. My treads are assassinating me.
What does that mean?
Treads? As in trainers?
Hey?
Trainers. The things on my feet. They don't fit too good.
Oh, well, come in and kick them off and put your legs up. I'll never run the feet, me.
You sure you don't like rum? Because you sounds like you does. Yeah, you sounds like a proper rum lover, all right.
Oh, I ain't loved so much in a long time.
Where?
Life, Nathan. Course of life.
Yeah, it's a drag, innit?
You're just the company I need. You want a drink, Nathan?
What you got?
Tea?
Okay, then.
How'd you like it?
3 sugars, please.
You got a sweet tooth.
I got more than one, lady. I'm 14.
Oh, I forgot.
What?
I don't have no milk.
I'll go and get some for you, you dizzy bird.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you so much, Nathan.
What for?
Oh, I need a bit of colour in my life. Here, take this for the milk.
20 quid. Ain't you got no change?
Spend the change on yourself, Nathan.
From 20 quid? Milk only costs 50p, you know. You for real or what?
For a little while longer, Nathan. Just for a little while longer.
Didn't think you was ever going to talk to me again. Raph?
Do you believe in ghosts?
What?
Ghosts, you know.
Nah.
Me neither.
Why are you asking?
Don't know. No reason.
You been alright, yeah?
Absolutely smashing.
Great. Really?
What do you think?
Sorry.
That's alright then.
Is it Bernie?
What do you think, Knowledge?
I believe in you.
What?
You know, you. I believe in you, Raph. I think you're really, you know.
What?
You know, nice.
She won't say nothing.
Bernie?
Mum and Dad are going mental.
You should meet my mum.
They're so upset.
She is insane.
Shouting.
Proper loopy.
Crying.
Always going on and on.
And going all silent.
Never doing nothing.
They're even talking about getting a vicar involved.
Always got some different
she
bloke.
She says
that.
She sees stuff.
She's
someone,
a loser.
Something. But she won't say what she sees.
I don't want to know.
I'm scared for you, you know, like really scared.
I don't care. She can do what she wants.
And they blame me for not looking after
making
her.
Making everything seem like it's my fault.
It is.
Huh?
If you hadn't not made Bernie drink that shake, she wouldn't have never gone into the toilets and everything wouldn't have...
I know I'm...
I don't know what to do to make things right again.
I do.
Yeah? What are you going to do, Knowledge? What are you going to do to make it all right? You weren't listening to me. You just waiting for your chance, weren't you?
No, I was...
Go away, Knowledge. Get away from
Raph,
me.
Please.
It's all your
Sorry.
Fault. And all you can do is make it worse.
Raph,
I hate
please,
you.
Please, don't.
Get away.
Please.
I really hate you for what you've done. I really hate you. I really hate you. I really hate you. I really hate you.
Lady... Are you there, lady? Lady? People think I'm a right weirdo for coming here and talking to you. They don't believe me. They can't see, they think I'm proper mental and stuff. They're right, aren't they? Because I am, and I am a weirdo. I'm like weird inside me. I can't even drink milk, I'm so weird. I'm like wrong inside. Nobody understands what it's like. Nobody understands. Lady, are you here? Are you listening to me? Lady, I know I promise. I will, I'll remember, I promise. Lady, what about Knowledge? What about Knowledge and me? What about me? Lady? Lady!
May the God of hope fill you with joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope.
Thank you for that, Pastor.
You are not alone, Juliet.
I know.
I'm here with you.
I know that.
And God? Can I make you more comfortable?
I am comfortable.
Good.
Except for the pain.
Faith is our fortitude and the fortune we take from this world.
Good, because I only get my pension.
But you have your faith.
And I don't have no savings.
All you need is faith. Juliet? Juliet?
Listen.
Shall I close the window?
No.
They're real.
What?
Those children, those voices, they're real children playing outside.
I know.
They aren't ghosts.
I know that. Just because I'm on my way out, everything don't have to be about ghosts, Pastor.
Sorry. Look, all we have in this world is our trust in God. What I'm saying is, we don't need to hear anything but that. There is no need for any other assurance.
Listen, Pastor. Listen.
Can I ask, did you have children of your own? You and Leslie, did you?
No.
I visited a family not far from here yesterday. They have a daughter, a young girl. And this girl has been claiming she hears a voice.
Is she deaf?
Pardon? No, no, she is not deaf.
She probably does then.
No, Juliet. The voice she claims to hear is not a real voice.
How does she hear it then?
She's troubled. She's a young person with a weight on her mind.
Oh, the young shouldn't have troubles.
I agree, but she has. She's a disturbed young girl. We can all feel anxious sometimes. Sometimes our mind tries to tell us something, and hearing voices is